Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With U.S. troops still under vigorous attack in Iraq, a stable Iraqi economy feels a long way off. But American troops and American billions in aid are likely to be welded to Iraq until its economy stands up. Washington economic advisors have been busily drawing up the outlines of a new Iraqi economy with foreign investment, new jobs, and free markets. Will it work? Tonight on Point, Dreams and Realities, Iraq's economy in America's image. We begin with the latest on the $87 billion White House request for Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill passed an Appropriations Committee vote in the House yesterday, 47-14, in spite of a vocal GOP push to convert some of the aid package into loans. Full House and Senate votes on the big package are expected next week. Jonathan Wiseman is financial reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him how the White House managed to get the reluctant House committee to back the president's request.
The White House really put the screws onto Republican conservatives in the House. They called them into the White House. Zach Womp, a Republican from Tennessee, had planned to introduce an amendment in the House Appropriations Committee yesterday that would have converted much, if not all, of the $20.3 billion in reconstruction funds for Iraq into loans that would have had to be repaid. And the president did not want this. He called Womp into his office in the White House and told him in no uncertain terms that would not fly, that would tie his hands. Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, called him up and said, as he recalled, all the United States ever requires from a liberated nation is a small plot of land to bury our dead. And Paul Bremer, the administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority, called from Baghdad to tell him that his proposal, which would have filtered these loans through an elected government in Baghdad, would have forced premature elections there, and that would be no good either.
So it was a full court press to give them the full $87 billion, not loans, but a straight-out grant. You quote Representative Wemp, a Republican from Tennessee, saying, "My God, if his eyes, that is President Bush's, had been lasers, mine would have been burned out." The president was really putting the pressure on in every way.
Yeah, one of my favorite things was that Womp started this whole thing yesterday saying that sometimes we have to stand our ground, but then he quickly made it clear that he was not going to be doing that.
So exactly what is the House Appropriations Committee then? What have they voted to give the president?
Now, they have trimmed back his rebuilding money somewhat, I think by $1.7 billion. It's not a lot of money overall in an $87 billion bill, but they got rid of many of the programs that had become real embarrassments to the Republicans. They got rid of a program to do new zip codes for Iraq. They got rid of a renumbering program for the phone system there. They got rid of a $10 million one-month business school course that worked out to be $10,000 a month or more than the tuition of Harvard Business School. They also got rid of $400 million to build two prisons at $50,000 a bed. That's more than twice the average cost of building prisons in the United States.
So all the things that could be made easy campaign issues, $50,000
exactly.
Garbage trucks, even maternity hospitals and working with the drained marshes in southern Iraq, that's off the table.
Right. Now, there are certainly a lot of things in there that still will make tempting campaign issues.
Such as?
U.S. taxpayers are still going to be paying for new museums in Iraq to commemorate the atrocities of Saddam Hussein. Certainly you can understand why Iraqis might want to commemorate those atrocities, but I'm not sure why that's emergency federal taxpayer spending. There is still huge amounts of money for contractors. At $200,000 a head, there are consultants on prison construction. There are consultants on crimes against humanity research. There are huge amounts of money for the training of the Iraqi military. And we understand that a lot of people would say that's necessary, but the cost of it is quite amazing, $153 million, and a lot of that is just to build a new curriculum for the training of the military.
What did the administration's argument against making some of this loans instead of an outright gift boil down to? What was their bottom line argument?
Their bottom line argument was that This is a country that already has an estimated $200 billion in debt, and piling on more debt would not only hurt Iraq, it would look very bad when the administration goes to Madrid October 23rd and 24th to ask its allies to come up with money for Iraqi reconstruction.
But the congressmen are clearly feeling heat from home. They didn't come up with all this fury just on their own. They have constituents who are complaining about this much money going out the door, and polls are showing a lot of American resistance to that. Nevertheless, they ultimately folded under pressure from the White House.
That's right. It's very interesting. Representative Jack Murtha from Pennsylvania, he's a Democrat, but he's a conservative Democrat, and he's usually very soft-spoken, stood up yesterday and said that he has received more mail saying don't vote for this $87 billion than he's ever received. And he told committee members that he was sure that they were receiving the same amount of mail.
The UN, IMF, World Bank have all said that Iraq will need a lot more money, maybe $36 billion over the next 4 years, and that's not counting security costs or investment in the oil industry. Is the Congress going to be asked to step up again with funds on this scale for Iraq?
Well, the administration likes to say that no, they hope that this $20 billion will do the trick because they will get money from other sources. But so far, we haven't seen any evidence that that money is going to come. And in fact, the administration has quietly told reporters and told everyone that they didn't expect very much money to come. So it's hard to imagine that the U.S. taxpayers aren't going to be asked to fund quite a bit more. In fact, the administration says these first installments are just to get things started. That maternity hospital that the administration wants to build in Basra, they asked for $100 or $200 million for it, but that's going to be a $700 to $900 million hospital. And there's no one else who looks like they're going to pick up the rest of the tab.
And they can't stop just laying the foundation. So paint the next few days for us. Where does this go in the House, in the Senate? When is the final vote? And are people now expecting the administration will come out with the full $87 billion that they've asked for?
The House will take it up probably Wednesday night with a vote on Thursday. And the House, which is famously subservient to the president these days, will almost certainly vote for the full amount as passed out by the Appropriations Committee. The Senate is a little more dicey. There is a bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats who would like to see at least some of this money turned into loans. But the problem is that Republicans want a certain amount. I think they want $10 billion. Democrats want $15 billion. They have different mechanisms for these loans. And from what I can gather right now, they're just so busy fighting amongst themselves that the president has basically taken the upper hand. I would expect that the president will get the full $87 billion, and I don't expect anything but perhaps a nominal amount being in loans.
Jonathan, thanks for filling us in.
You're welcome.
Jonathan Wiseman is financial reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. As part of a White House press swing to shore up support for the war on terror and U.S. reconstruction efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan, Vice President Dick Cheney had this to say in a speech at the Heritage Foundation earlier today.
Iraq has become the central front in the war on terror. It was crucial that we enforce the U.N. Security Council resolutions. Now, having liberated that country, it is crucial that we keep our word to the Iraqi people, helping them to build a secure country and a democratic government. And we will do so.
Real security for Iraq will not come until the guerrilla war there stops and a revived economy kicks into gear. American planners have a lot to say about the shape of that economy. If it doesn't work out, the current $87 billion bill won't be the last. Tonight, we're talking with the Bush administration's point man on reshaping and reviving the Iraqi economy, about short-term and long-term economic prospects for that country, for free markets and foreign investment, for job creation and economic growth. Do you remember when the Bush administration said that Iraq's reconstruction would essentially pay for itself? And can you imagine a time when Iraq will be ready to survive without U.S. support? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from East Lansing, Michigan, is Peter McPherson, president of Michigan State University. For the past 4 months, he was the Bush administration's top economic advisor in Iraq, reporting to U.S. Civilian Administrator Paul Bremer. On Monday, he met with President Bush to review the reforms he's implemented and designed there. Good evening and welcome, Peter McPherson.
Well, let me just say that the comments last few minutes, I think you guys missed the forest in focusing on some trees. I mean, the big picture is that there is huge progress going on there, including changes in the economy. And I'm happy to be here because I was kind of surprised by the back and forth.
Well, Peter McPherson, about looking at the forest and the trees tonight, and we're delighted you're here.
Yeah,
we've been following you in Iraq. We've seen you've been right there in the middle of it all.
Now, by the way, I was there for these 4 months, but and this was very much a back and forth with Iraqis on so many of these projects. And I think we got to be careful to see that the finance minister of the interim government gave the key speech laying out the changes that he thought and the governing council strongly supported. I'd be careful about just simply calling this an American plan, and surely this was not my plan in any sense, and I want to be clear about that up front.
Peter McPherson, we hear you coming on like gangbusters at the same time.
Right.
At the same time,
back and forth, you guys. I mean, they're really, when you look at the country.
Hey, wait just a minute. I just want to say one thing, because you're coming on prickly here. It's an interesting, we're happy to have it. But listen, there's an interesting dynamic here. We want to have that. But I should point one thing out. You're on this show tonight because the White House called us to offer you up, presumably as part of this week's PR push on Iraq. We're delighted to have you. You've been right in the middle of it, and we want to hear all about it. But it's an interesting dynamic because the White House does not often call this White House to offer us guests of your stature. We're happy to have you in that capacity.
I like to be here.
We want to get all the details tonight, but let's dive into it.
All right, let's do it.
Starting right here, you've been in Iraq for a long time, stepping away from your post at Michigan State, checking out what's going on there, helping design plans for this new economy. We've read about the memo that Paul Bremer put out in August. Presumably, you helped draft that memo with the design of what that economy will look like. First, basic question, how many billions more beyond this $87 billion do you anticipate, Peter McPherson, the United States government will need to pour into Iraq?
It, of course, isn't absolutely clear, but this $20.3 billion, I would imagine to be a significant portion of it. What we found when we arrived in Iraq was the infrastructure practically didn't exist. It hadn't had maintenance for 20-plus years.
20-plus years. So you're saying even before the U.N. embargo in Iraq.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There was tremendous looting that destroyed a great many things. The war, of course, did destroy some, but the looting was much more important. And that infrastructure is so key to even immediate economic activity. $15 billion of the supplemental, broadly defined, goes into infrastructure. Now, I'm not an expert in all the components of the supplemental, but I do think that electricity and that sort of thing, sewer and water, are very important investments to make.
Is that going to be enough to kickstart this economy or put it in a position to be kickstarted so that it can begin to take care of itself?
Well, it'll take a while. I mean, every post-war transitional economy like in Central America, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, those economies took a while to get going. What we did immediately was to work hard on a safety net. The UN Oil for Food Program had a massive food distribution effort that certainly avoided immediate starvation or that kind of problem. But we began to pay in June 1.3 million employees and about a million pensioners shortly thereafter. That was really quite an undertaking. We didn't have the list of the employees to begin with. Got the list, worked out the process, got the money around the country.
Is the Iraqi economy today basically the U.S. government treasury?
Well, there's a very active retail market. If you go down Rashid Street in Baghdad, for example, I've never been in a more bustling area than that part of than that street. And around the country, there's a lot of retail activity.
So retail's coming back. A lot of big effort still to come on the front of reforming and reviving this economy. Peter McPherson, president of Michigan State University, point man on the economy in Iraq for the U.S. government. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about rebuilding the Iraqi economy tonight, about American hopes, plans, and problems there. How long are you willing to wait for Iraq to function without a U.S. subsidy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Peter McPherson. He's president of Michigan State University. He took 4 months off from that job to go to Iraq post-war and help everybody there figure out how to design and implement a new economy to pull Iraq up out of the deep hole that years of mismanagement and embargo had left it in. He's with us tonight to bring us up to date on all that. You can join the conversation as well. Do you remember when the Bush administration said Iraq's reconstruction would essentially pay for itself? And how long until an Iraqi economy can function without U.S. troops keeping the peace? We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter McPherson, we want to hear from you about the vision of how this economy ought to, may evolve. But before we do that, I wish you would point us to some of the progress that's been made in Iraq since the war. We read in the New York Times today, you know, this sort of terrible balance. On the one hand, this drip torture of the bombings and the deaths of Iraqi civilians and U.S. soldiers. On the other hand, the Times reporter saying a lot has been done there. Paul Bremer's been briefing on that just this week, had the misfortune of having to do that right in the face of the car bombing at the police headquarters in Baghdad yesterday. But how would you describe what's happened so far in laying down an infrastructure for a new Iraqi economy?
I think reasonable progress has been made, actually. As I look at getting a safety net in place, roughly in place. As I look, a new currency having been announced on October 15th, that new currency will be swapped for the old between then and January 15th.
No more Saddam Hussein on the bills.
Yes, but the real problem wasn't the Saddam on the bills. The real problem was that there were only two denominations, like as if you had a dime and a $5 bill, and that was all you could use.
Tough to do business that way.
To do business. Mm-hmm. There was another currency in the north that had some other problems. That was thought to be a controversial decision before it was made, but when it was, everybody is extremely pleased about having done that. There's a set of economic reforms. I mentioned the finance minister having just announced that allows foreign investment, tax reform, flat tariffs, basically opening up the economy in a way that no one else in the Middle East is open. The Iraqis decided that they really wanted to have, they needed jobs, and they thought this way to do it. Now, the reason I was pushing back a bit a moment ago on this being kind of all-America plan was that I sat down with the Economic Committee of the Governing Council.
This one headed up by Ahmad Chalabi.
Yes, this month. It rotates, last month, actually.
Okay.
It rotates month by month.
Mm-hmm.
And went down through a series of drafts on these proposals that were on the table. And it felt very much like an executive session of a congressional legislative committee that I've been in lots of times to work out a piece of legislation. They wanted this or they didn't want that, or it was an excellent discussion with real engagement. And it seems to me that what people on the ground, regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats or party involvement. And back here in the United States, I'm a president of a huge university. I'm not at all engaged in partisan politics.
Mm-hmm.
What people on the ground feel is that there is regular progress. You look month by month at the economy, at healthcare delivery, at school systems, university systems, and there's real progress that seems like a major disconnect between what's being reported back here. I read the New York Times piece this morning, And frankly, it seemed to me to kind of poo-poo the progress and say, yes, there's these things, but the security overwhelms it. I don't get that feeling. Security is real.
It's a real problem.
Security, yeah, the insecurity, and we read about convoys of cars coming in from Amman, Jordan, still being held up by essentially bandits on the highway to Baghdad. Not exactly a big incentive for foreign investors.
Well, that may be true, but that there's some of that, but there is on the streets and cities around the country a huge amount of foreign goods being sold. They're getting there.
Try and put some quantity on this security issue for us. What degree of drag on the economic economy do you see the insecurity that we read about representing? I mean, is it going to cut Iraq's potential growth in half or by a third? Can Iraq really flourish if this instability, the insurgency, whatever you want to call it, isn't put to bed?
What I guess I object to here in the earlier questions and comments mm-hmm. that you're making is there's an assumption that somehow or the other this should be easy and not messy. I've worked all over the world. I started off as a Peace Corps volunteer in Peru in the 60s, and change and economic, social change is hard, is messy. There's always pieces that you can pick up and say this is wrong or that's wrong. But what I would say to you is that when you have banks now open that weren't, you have health clinics that are open and delivering services, schools, a new currency, an economic policy format, you've got all this retail activity. These are important things that people continue to live and get along, send their kids to school, have money to buy things. Not everybody, but a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's going to take some time. It'll be messy.
Peter McPherson, I think we buy that. And if you hear skepticism, I suppose it's born of a couple of things. One was the way the war was presented before the country went in. Weapons of mass destruction, not yet found. The other was a fairly steady drumbeat from the Bush administration that oil revenues would take care of a lot, perhaps even cover the full cost of this. That's not happening. And finally, right now, Americans are being asked to pony up another $87 billion and many more billions to come. So it's not that we don't understand it will take a while, but we've learned to exercise a little skepticism here. But we really do want to hear what's actually going on this front of changing the Iraqi.
Well, what I would say, and I don't know exactly what statements. I'm not a scholar of pre-war and how all that occurred or didn't occur, but I know that from about 30 years of working in developing countries in one role or the other, that one change is messy. It really is. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It comes in fits and starts, and a day can be frustrating, and the next day you get things done.
Mm-hmm.
Two, that security issues people live with and continue to work ordinarily, and that I see occurring. Now, that doesn't mean it will be. It is a problem, and it must be dealt with. That's why $5 billion of the $20.3 billion is, in fact, security-related money.
Can we look at one of the central kind of thrusts of the economic reforms that are being contemplated here, and that is foreign direct investment allowed to flow in quite freely, international banks involved, tariffs down. As I understand it, this is not what Iraq has had, maybe ever, and certainly not recently.
Nobody in the region, frankly.
Nobody in the region, including Iraq. And we were talking about Ahmad Chalabi earlier, who's quoted as saying, many on the council have not overcome their fears about the need for protection. The culture of the Iraqis has been a culture of fear that foreigners would take advantage of the country. What's your sense of the real receptivity, the real beyond the finance minister? Is Iraq prepared to welcome this kind of throwing open the gates, foreign investment coming in at a time when they don't have a lot of capital themselves? On the one hand, they need it. On the other hand, foreigners are going to end up owning a lot of things. Are Iraqis ready to participate in the program that's being laid before them?
Well, keep in mind the Governing Council was a group I was talking about a moment ago,
mm-hmm.
the committee of the Governing Council, and then dealing with the full council. The Governing Council was involved in and approve these proposals. There's no question that this is a significant change that came about. There was conflicting fears, fear of change and foreigners, I suppose, to some degree, but also fear of not having jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The World Bank was deeply engaged in setting forth the case why the country had to open up to foreign investment, and they felt strongly it should be 100%. They pointed out that all of the Middle East in 2002 only had $4 billion of foreign investment. Mm-hmm. Sub-Saharan Africa had $7 billion. Latin America had $40-plus billion.
Is this because it was closed to foreign investment or had so much oil money it didn't need it?
Well, I think the facts are that probably both, but mm-hmm. I think being closed was a significant part of this. Mm-hmm. Jordan has begun to opened up some significant ways. But the Middle East has been a relatively closed, inward-looking economy. Not relative, quite. Probably the most closed in the world now.
But you think that Iraq, beyond the governing council, beyond the old palace where Paul Bremer sits and where you no doubt sat with him making these plans, you think Iraq at large it stands ready to see the doors opened up and this kind of radical change?
I think there's going to be controversy about anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in fact, I talk about messiness in terms of economic changes and other areas of the economy and society. The political process is messy. I mean, there's on the governing council. There's a council that represents views across geography,
mm-hmm.
And they don't all agree with each other, and they make public statements about this and that. I believe that we're going to see for some time various views. Not everyone's will agree on the open policy. We're going to see lots of struggles, and I think this is part of the political maturing that needs to occur as they proceed toward a constitution.
And not the least of their worries, the fact that there were very wealthy businessmen under Saddam Hussein who presumably have come through everything that's happened with some of that wealth, and they may not want to see those Ba'athist rich guys back in the driver's seat. Peter McPherson, if you'll stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome into our conversation Kiran Chowdhury. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California in Berkeley. She's author of The Price of Wealth, Economies, and Institutions in the Middle East. Good evening, and welcome, Kiran Chowdhury.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us. We're talking with Peter McPherson, who's just back from 4 months of heavy lifting in Iraq on the economic front. And you've probably seen, like we have, the economic plans coming out of his conversations with Paul Bremer, with the Iraqi Governing Council, to really open this economy up, to get foreign capital, foreign banks in there, to bring tariffs down, to keep taxes low, to try and kickstart this Iraqi economy. What do you think? Is this a working formula?
Well, I'm really surprised to hear that this came out of intensive meetings with the Governing Council and between them and economic experts, because this is absolutely a utopian document.
You're talking about this 3 or 4 page outline
of
the shape of Iraq to come, the economy.
Yes, it deals with direct foreign investment, international banking, commercial banking, taxes, and tariffs. You know, if we had this kind of an economy in this country, I think we'd all be happier. It's a particular kind of utopia because it's a free market utopia of a kind that even the World Bank and the IMF no longer support. I was thinking that, you know, laws only function in society and you can pass them, but they're not going to work unless you have support and institutions on the ground. So let me just run through some of the things that I think are problematic.
And then we'll get Peter McPherson's response, please.
Yeah, and I think the American people really need to understand and be told what's actually going to happen here. And here are some contextual facts. There really is a growing civil war in Iraq in which there are regional rivalries and armed factions that are becoming more and more organized. There is no state in Iraq. There is no police that's functioning. There's no law and order.
Well, there are some police and some law and order, but not much, we can see.
Well, I want to actually get into what Ba'athist Iraq looked like, to contextualize that from the perspective of Iraqis. But if I can just run through my little list. There's no basic infrastructure, unlike Saddam Hussein, who after the bombing of 1990-91 was able to get electricity and running water back within 2 weeks. We are now into the sixth month of the American occupation. This is a country that has multiple currencies and jurisdictions, and it's not at all clear that people are going to accept the new currency that's being minted. This is a country with a debt, as you mentioned earlier, of $200 billion, much of which is owed to other countries than the United States and U.S. banks. So there's a huge drain that's going to happen anyway unless the United States manages to get this $200 billion forgiven somehow.
Right. So we know they've got a lot of problems. The point here is to get the country pointed in a direction that can pull it up out of that ditch. Do you see this 3-4-page plan as the right direction?
Well, I don't. I think, you know, I think that one of the things that you raised earlier is really important. These are sweeping laws that are enacted in conjunction or through the Governing Council, which is a deeply unpopular and contested institution. So you're starting out on the wrong foot. And you're dealing with a country that has a history of state intervention in the economy that is actually remarkable.
Remarkable in a positive or negative way?
Well, remarkable in the sense of the depth and the size of it. Even when Iraq was at war with Iran between 1979 and 1988, and after 1990, under the sanctions regime, the Ba'athist Party managed somehow, and through massive repression, obviously, as well, to guarantee a certain level of economic stability. And
that's a pretty long list already. I want to get Peter McPherson here to respond. And I guess the first question there, Peter McPherson, is Kiran Choudhury looks at this plan for Iraq's economy and says this is a utopian document.
Well, the World Bank was strongly supportive of 100% foreign investment. The reality is that we haven't been able to get real growth even within a couple-year period without substantial market opening.
You mean anywhere else around the world?
Any place else in the world, really, after a post-war or a transition economy like Central Europe. The Ba'athist economy was really a Stalinist economy. It was so intrusive, so massively inefficient, that to not deal with that and open it up, it seems to me, is a fundamental mistake. She mentioned the currency. I was there for those months, Professor, and frankly, after the decision was clamored for to have a new currency. And I have heard nobody, except for up north, complaining or concerned about the rate of exchange, and even that seems to diminish some. I've heard nobody complain about a new currency.
But are you saying this is not utopian? This is simply long-term structure for growth?
No, I think that it's sound long-term structure for growth. I think that's a good way to phrase it. And she mentioned electricity. The electricity, our figures are now at pre-war levels. But there was such massive looting and before that, lack of maintenance, that the whole thing came crumbling down.
Peter McPherson, stand by. Kiran Choudhury, I'm sure you have a response there. We're talking about rebuilding the Iraqi economy. A lot hinges on it. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about rebuilding the Iraqi economy, about American hopes, plans, and problems in launching a self-sustaining Iraq. My guests tonight are Peter McPherson. He's president of Michigan State University, just back from 4 months in Iraq, where he was the administration's point man on economic planning for that country. And from Berkeley, California, Kiran Choudhury. She's associate professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley. Got a lot of questions about what we're seeing here tonight. Peter McPherson says, and the documents that have been crafted in Baghdad say, let's open up this economy and let it grow. Kiran Choudhury says, you're dreaming. There's no state. There's a civil war. There's no infrastructure. There's $200 billion in debt, and there's no tradition of this kind of growth. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Good evening. Yeah, my comment is a lot of people have a short memory. It seems like after the Second World War, France and Germany didn't have any infrastructure either.
Mm-hmm.
And it took 2 years for the United States to develop the Marshall Plan to feed these people and get them back on their feet. And then when Russia put the Berlin Wall around, the United States again airlifted supplies into Berlin, and no one was complaining about the costs of those investments or involvements by this country.
So you're saying it's never easy. We've got to have some patience here.
Well, that's true, because you've got people that Dag Hammarskjöld said it a long time ago, that it takes maybe two generations to change the mindset of some of the people from what they've been brought up with. And with the Iraqis or anybody in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, it's going to take about two generations, but I think we'll see movement within 2 or 3 years.
We can hope for that. Jack, thanks for your call. Kiran Chaudhry, how about it? Jack is looking back at history and saying, give them the right structure and then be patient. It's not going to be easy.
I, you know, couldn't be a stronger advocate for long memories. And let me just refresh our memory about U.S. involvement in Iraq. The 1963 coup that took down Abdul Karim Qasim was largely led by the United States. The United States supported Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, and right up until the 1989 reforms that Saddam Hussein instituted. The difference between World War II and this case, or the difference between the struggle against socialism and the Iraq case, is that it is an illegitimate, in the minds of many Americans, commitment. So that people aren't willing to make sacrifices.
Are you saying that you're so opposed to the U.S. intervention at a fundamental level that everything else doesn't matter, that the economic plans don't matter? It's fundamentally illegitimate? Can we afford that attitude?
I actually wanted to get right into the foreign direct investment issue, but let me say that I am and have been and was for years, while the United States was supporting Saddam Hussein, an advocate of stopping that support, and I am not in favor of getting out of Iraq.
So what's illegitimate?
What's illegitimate is that Americans don't understand our history there, and therefore this cost of reconstruction is coming out of the blue for them. But if they did, then they would understand that we really do have a responsibility.
If you've helped build the problem for years, you've got to be ready to help fix it for years.
That's very constructive to say, look, we're there. You can disagree about the war or not, but we're there. There's massive infrastructure needs. We have electricity up to pre-war levels, but there are huge other problems, more than what anyone would have reasonably expected given the looting and the rest of it. Now let's get on with that business. Now, I do recognize that an open economy is something that there'll be a dispute about. The World Bank was a very aggressive advocate for this, Professor. They really were. And the whole Middle East has been quite a closed economy, by and large.
Do you fear, Peter McPherson, a kind of reaction to that open economy that may make more instability? You know, it's a big shock to countries who haven't had it. It may be the best recipe for growth, but could it create social backlash that will give problems to a new government, to the United States?
Well, there was a study done by the bank, by the World Bank, that looked at post-war and transition economies, those post-Soviet economies. And what they found was that unless you aggressively put in place economic reforms and cut back subsidies to state enterprises, thereby giving an opportunity for small and medium-sized businesses to come in and grow, you couldn't make it work. It took much longer than ever occurred. And there's further studies saying that one of the best way to get medium and small businesses is to get foreign investment, which feed, take supplies from, et cetera, those small, medium-sized local businesses.
We are clearly not going to get this settled tonight. Kiran Chaudhry, we literally have 1 minute left. In that minute, what do you think? What's your recipe? If not open markets, then what?
No, I'm not saying not open markets. I'm saying that foreign investment is not going to come to Iraq. under these conditions. And so for
they'd just
us
be
to
scared to come. It's too insecure, so it's not going to work for that reason.
Sure, but it's a tiny market. You're talking about 23 million people.
So is it going to depend on continued appropriations by the U.S. Congress?
I think for a long time it is.
Let me just say that when I was there, knocking on my door, were regional banks who wanted to get in immediately.
Well, we're going to see very quickly whether or not investors show up for the party, but it's a
There'll be some. There'll be some.
Not an avalanche, but there'll be some. Peter McPherson, very good of you to come on tonight.
It's
thanks,
a pleasure.
Thanks for
I'm
your
glad
work
I
and
came.
Thanks for joining us. Peter McPherson, president of Michigan State University. He was financial coordinator in the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq under Paul Bremer from May to September this year. He just returned 2 weeks ago. And Kieran Chowdhury, we've got to hear more from you, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Kieran Chowdhury, associate professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, author of The Price of Wealth, Economies and Institutions in the Middle East. You can continue this conversation at our website. Go to onepointradio.org. In a moment, marking the anniversary of the resignation of an infamous vice president. This is On Point. Thirty years ago today, Spiro Agnew resigned as vice president under Richard Nixon. At the time, the Nixon administration was engulfed by the Watergate scandal, and the inflammatory Agnew had few political friends. An investigation of income tax fraud and evasion brought an indictment. Agnew pleaded no contest and resigned. Tonight, On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors brings back the career of a controversial conservative figure in sound.
The 1968 presidential campaign that pitted Vice President Hubert Humphrey against Richard Nixon was enlivened by a TV commercial that had no voiceover. A camera slowly pulled away from a black and white TV screen. On a gray background, the words, Agnew for Vice President. Someone starts to laugh. At the close of the commercial, the screen fades to black and these words appeared. This would be funny if it weren't so serious. The ad was pulled early on. Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew managed a slim victory over a deeply divided Democratic Party, and in the deepening mess of Vietnam, an imperial president and his law and order sidekick sallied forth into a good cop, bad cop routine played out on a national stage. The Democrats were right about one thing. It wasn't funny.
In the case of the Vietnam moratorium, the objective announced by the leader, immediate, unilateral withdrawal of all our forces from Vietnam, was not only unsound, but idiotic.
The new vice president found himself in demand as an angry, polarizing voice in an angry, polarized time. His target? The children of the post-war baby boom, flexing their economic, political, and demographic muscle in the erupting Kulturkampf that continues to form the great divide in our political culture today. Here Agnew speaks to those who wanted a kinder, gentler VP.
And if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems that Washington and Lincoln as presidents brought forth in this country will shut up and work within our free system of government, I will lower my voice.
There was something about the words speechwriter William Safire put in Agnew's mouth that begged parody. Strings of alliteration that might have made an English professor of the time, radical or otherwise, wince.
In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism. Actually, they've formed their own 4-H club. The hopeless, hysterical hypochondriacs of history.
The humorous possibilities of Agnew's screeds weren't lost on comedian David Fry. In late 1969, Elektra Records released Fry's I Am the President. He sounded more like Nixon than Nixon. Here's Fry doing both voices as the president tries to figure out what to do with Spiro.
Spiro, why did you go out and make a speech?
Well, I wanted someone to talk to.
Won't my son-in-law, Mr. Eisenhower, talk to you anymore?
Well, he uses small words. I use big words like impudent and deceit. Spurl,
do you know how much I have to pay Mr. Eisenhower to talk to you?
Unlike many vice presidents who languished far from the political spotlight, Agnew found himself in great demand as a public speaker and something of a lightning rod as the congressional election of 1970 neared. Maybe the Republican National Committee figured that if a comedian could parody the imperial presidency on record, they could make a record too.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's the Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew, speaking out on radicalism.
A few months before the election, the Republican Party found a new use for a marketing device that had worked for General Mills back in the 50s when they glued inexpensive plastic Musketeers records onto Wheaties boxes. The National Committee took excerpts of Agnew's speeches and sent out a free record as a teaser for a 12-inch Agnew LP and a solicitation for money.
In the name of academic freedom, they destroy academic freedom. Denouncing violence, they seize and vandalize the buildings of great universities. Fiercely expressing their respect for truth, they disavow the logic and discipline necessary to pursue truth. They would have us believe that they alone know what is good for America, what is true and right and beautiful.
Late in 1970, New York-based Podium Records released another LP, Spiro T. Agnew, The Speeches That Stirred America. The liner notes revealed something that might have surprised his critics on the left. When he wasn't throwing ideological bombs, Agnew, in his private moments, enjoyed golf and the music of Lawrence Welk and Mantovani.
SDS, PLP, Weatherman 1, Weatherman 2, the Revolutionary Action Movement, Panthers, Lions, hippies, yippies, tigers alike. I'd rather swap the whole damn zoo for a single platoon of the kind of young Americans I saw in Vietnam.
Yeah, come on, all you big strong men, and Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun.
In the context of this great cultural divide, a fractious Democratic Party nominated anti-war candidates George McGovern and Sergeant Shriver in 1972 to oppose the incumbent Nixon and Agnew, who handily won the election. Early in the second term, Agnew received an unwelcome notice that he was the subject of a federal investigation for accepting bribes in his former job as governor of Maryland. In a bizarre twist, it wasn't the payoffs that first got him into trouble. It was the failure to pay $13,000 of tax on this illegal income. Agnew pleaded nolo and resigned from the vice presidency on October 10, 1973. As the Vietnam War wound down and the culture wars quieted, Agnew returned to Maryland, where he was disbarred, and long after the war was over, forced to pay the state of Maryland $268,000, the state's calculation of the bribes he'd accepted, plus interest. An ironic end to the career of a man who had big plans for the Department of Justice.
The criminal left is not a problem to be solved by the Department of Philosophy or the Department of English or the Department of Sociology. It's a problem for the Department of Justice.
Today we're less inclined to make records, parodies or otherwise, of our political figures. It's too bad. A CD of the wisdom of George W. Bush or the wit of Dick Cheney, dug up at a flea market in 2033, might provide some worthwhile insights.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to just a few excerpts from Vice President Agnew's speeches. If you'd like to hear more, the Republican National Finance Committee will be...
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Some of his most thought-provoking and hard-hitting talks. You'll find full details of the special offer in the letter...